Welcome everyone and happy October. I figured we could talk a little about cryptids in the spirit of the season. Fair warning, I don't think the cryptid content I have planned for the Halloween season is going to make anyone that happy. I'm too skeptical for the believers in the paranormal and too charitable to the paranormal for the skeptics. For those who don't know, a cryptid is an animal unrecognized by the scientific community. Skeptics reject them as folklore and myth, supported only by sketchy anecdotes and bad photographs. Bigfoot, skinwalkers, the Jersey Devil, Mothman, and the Chupacabra are all considered cryptids today. And though these creatures are often shoehorned into the category of the paranormal, there's a wide range of opinion concerning the nature of these animals. Perhaps they are undiscovered species, yet to be recognized and cataloged by the scientific community. Others attribute extraordinary abilities to these creatures that would require, let's say, a deeper reevaluation of received wisdom. So I'm naturally inclined towards the ordinary but undiscovered end of the spectrum regarding my own experience with a cryptid. And there's a precedent here. Many species we know about today were once considered cryptids. In Conversations in Science at Indiana University, Lisi Davis notes that the giant squid, the kangaroo, and the platypus were once cryptids. And the platypus was initially dismissed as a hoax, which is kind of understandable. Komodo dragons were treated as legend until 1910. Gorillas remained unrecognized by the Western scientific community until the mid-19th century, shortly before the publication of The Origin of Species. Of course, eyewitness testimony of gorillas existed long prior to their official recognition. However, many eyewitness accounts supporting the existence of the great ape were provided by Africans, and the Europeans who heard their testimony dismissed the superstitious primitive people and their tall tales. Some of you may know that I had an experience with a cryptid when I was 17, and a few months back I appeared on a podcast called Otherworld, hosted by Jack Wagner, to talk about it. Hopefully he doesn't mind me reposting that interview. Their show is much bigger than mine, but I'll still try to make up for it by shilling for them a bit. I'm going to tell you about my favorite episodes of the show and why I like them at the end of this video if you stick around, and you can support Otherworld on Patreon. First, this is my interview with Jack, plus a bunch of bonus content that didn't appear on Otherworld. We spoke for over an hour, but the final product was not as long as that. Otherworld is a story-based podcast. It's not really like Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, for example, which analyzes stories like this and tries to explain them. On the show, I went into analysis mode for a long time, trying to give a naturalistic account of my experience, and I also complained a lot about the online skeptic community, which Jack probably rightly cut out, but I like analyzing these stories rather than just telling the stories and leaving it open-ended, so I'm going to post our whole conversation here, which you can't get anywhere else, but do still listen to episodes 113 and 114 of Otherworld, because he interviewed a few other people about the same subject, including the man who created a successful hoax around it. I also very much enjoyed the interview with a wolf researcher, which I included at the end. I think she provides some valuable information that's relevant to the case. So this is the beginning of episode 113 of Otherworld, and the tail end of episode 114. All right, so without further ado, here's my extended appearance on Otherworld.
Welcome to Otherworld. I'm your host, Jack Wagner. This story comes in from a guy named Emerson, and it takes place in a small town called Bloomingdale, Michigan. Something that I think is noteworthy about Emerson and maybe a little funny is that not only did he tell me that he has always been a hardcore skeptic, he also told me that he was once a very active member in the online skeptic community. Despite this, he ended up having a very strange experience while walking in the woods one day with an ex-girlfriend. An experience that he couldn't quite rationalize, no matter how many times he tried, and he still struggles with it to this day, despite many attempts at explaining it. Emerson's story is actually quite a simple one, but it ended up sending me down quite a rabbit hole. This is episode 113. The title is The Michigan Dogman Part 1, and you're listening to Otherworld.
Hello?
Is this Bobby?
Yes, it is.
At its core, the science you can't argue with.
A story about
all of a sudden.
Up in the sky.
It's almost frustrating that it's happening.
I'm gonna die. I've got
like,
its
looking.
Limbs were just like wrong.
It was just there.
Everybody moves back into the light, even if it takes them a minute.
My name is Emerson. I'm the oldest of four siblings. I'm about to be a dad. My wife is due any day now with our first. Actually, by the time this comes out, I might be a dad. So I'm excited about that. And I grew up in Michigan. Spent most of my life in Michigan. Just recently moved to Northern California. But yeah, this took place in Michigan. I grew up in like a Christian environment and sort of reacted against that. Like my family's in ministry, like a lot of it's in ministry. Like my uncle's a pastor, my grandpa's a pastor. My parents have both been in and out of part or full-time Christian ministry. And when I was like in my later teens, I started reacting against that a little bit. If you remember like the new atheist movement, I was like pretty into that sort of thing and like pretty skeptical. And I guess it's kind of ironic because what happened to me that we're talking about today, that happened like right at the beginning of me becoming like a pretty hardcore skeptic for like, I don't know, 5 or 6 years or something like that. And this did not square well with the rest of it. And I honestly like tried not to think about it. Told a couple people, did not exactly get like a warm reception. And then just kind of kept it to myself. But yeah, I was pretty active in like the online skeptic community for a few years. After this happened, I was surprised you haven't bumped into them a couple times, but it's just like a group of dorks on the internet who try to like, well, I mean, like their purported goals, it's like, oh, we want to promote science and rationality and we want to, you know, we want people to have beliefs that are based on the evidence, you know, stuff that sounds really unobjectionable, but I just don't think they live up to their professed values. But anyway, they have like a list of things that they don't like that they think is, you know, oh, no one should believe in, you know, cryptids or ghosts or anything religious or aliens. You know, they just have this list of things they don't like and then they attack constantly. And it's going to be hard for me not to go into ranting about them just because I was like a part of that group for several years and then just came to see how superficial their understanding of some of these things are. Like, they don't seem to understand what people really believe or, like, why they believe it. But I ended up getting kind of pulled into their orbit for a few years and then, yeah, only recently kind of left that. So when this happened, I was 17. I was living in Michigan and still in high school. So my girlfriend and I, we'd been dating for about a year and a half. We were hanging out. We were trying to get away from people a little bit. So we were at my house. This is like a house that's like set back in the woods a little bit, has like a really long driveway. It's just like surrounded by farmland and and forest in pretty much every direction. And there's literally only like a few hundred people who live in this town. It's like super rural. So we're kind of on the outskirts of Bloomingdale. And we're just in the middle of nowhere. This was in the middle of the day. So this is like broad daylight, like just right in the middle of the day, early afternoon. Yeah, and we just decided to go on a walk to get away from people. Like I said, I'm the oldest of four siblings. So I have these, you know, two younger brothers and younger sister that are around the house probably. And both my parents are there. So we probably just wanted to get away and get some privacy. So we were going on a walk through the woods. So we left the house and then just started heading off into the woods in the, you know, right after, like in the early afternoon. So we took like a trail, you know, into the woods. It's like summertime. So, you know, like the leaves are green and everything. It's not like fall or winter.
We started on the trail and then we kind of went off the trail like halfway through. So we're kind of in the middle of the woods, like just surrounded by trees. You know, there's not like a clear straight path anywhere. You know, we're still heading deeper into the woods. And then out of nowhere, there's just this wolf standing there, maybe like 30 or 40 feet away. Like it's pretty close. And that's not like a common occurrence in Michigan. Like there are wolves in the upper peninsula of Michigan, but not so much in the lower peninsula. We're in like southwest Michigan. So this is not like a normal thing that you run into in Michigan all the time. It's never happened to me before or since. So all of a sudden there's just a wolf there, you know, like a kind of grayish looking wolf. It's obviously not a dog. It's like much bigger. And we were like far enough in the woods that's like, it's pretty alarming to be like that far away. You can't just like dart back into the house or something. Like we were, you know, at least a few hundred yards into the woods, like thick, dense woods. So it's like, it was just immediately pretty frightening because, apparently wolves don't really attack humans that often, but I didn't know that because it's just not a common occurrence. So all of a sudden this thing is just right in front of us, you know, maybe 40 feet away. And, we were alarmed, so we turned around and started walking back, like trying to stay calm, but, you know, moving kind of briskly. Like we were trying to get back as soon as we could because we were, you know, pretty far out. Like we were both kind of panicking, and we just said, okay, let's go back to the house. We're kind of like walking briskly back towards the house in the general direction. And the wolf kind of like kept pace with us. Like it obviously saw us and it was walking parallel to us. This is so stupid, but I was thinking like, okay, don't act afraid. Like don't start running because then he'll respond to us and like charge at us or something. So she was like walking in front of me and I was kind of to her right in between her and the wolf, but like slightly behind her because there was no clear path that we were on at this point. So we're kind of having to like weave between trees and stuff. So she's kind of leading the way and I'm kind of in between her and the wolf. And she kept trying to go faster than I wanted her to go. I'm like, no, stay calm. Like just walk slowly. Like don't make any sudden movements. But she was just too afraid. So she keeps like picking up the pace little by little. And I'm like trying to tell her to slow down. So she's freaking out. You know, obviously we're both very afraid because it just feels like we're cornered in a way. Like it's a scary feeling, you know, to be out there kind of exposed. Like there's no cover, you know, there's like nowhere you can dart off to. And this thing could just easily kill you if it wants to. It's faster than you. It's stronger than you. And you're just completely at its mercy. So like, you know, the adrenaline was really pumping. I'm trying to stay calm at least, but she just keeps moving faster and faster. You know, I'm keeping an eye on the wolf and he's like off to my right. So I'm kind of like, you know, looking over at her and like kind of following her, like dodging and weaving through the trees. And I'm looking back over at him. And, you know, we keep moving progressively faster and faster. And finally, the fear just got the better of us. And we're just like running at this point. So she's like a couple yards ahead of me. And I'm looking every other second, like alternating between kind of weaving between trees and making sure that he's not coming towards us. Then something unusual happened. The wolf just stood up on its hind legs and kept running. And I was already afraid at that point. You know, we were thinking in the back of our minds, like we might get mauled by a wolf or something. But that just like morphed into something greater at that point. And I just like couldn't look away. I was just transfixed on this, what looked like an upright wolf. It looks like it could easily be 6 feet tall or 7 feet tall. It's standing really comfortably. I mean, it wasn't standing still. It was moving the whole time. And it was moving along really quickly. It wasn't like unsure. You know, it moved really ably on two legs. I mean, like it was trotting on four legs. And then at some point it just kind of backed up. It like reared up on its hind legs and it just didn't slow down at all. It just kept propelling forward on two legs. It just kept running. In my memory, it was holding its arms out in front of it like an animal would or like a canine would. It wasn't like pumping its arms like a man would. You know, it always looked like a wolf, but that detail about the arms has me questioning because I didn't notice anything in particular about the way the arms were moving. But I do remember that when it was running very naturally. And any other video I've seen of a dog kind of moving around shakily on two legs, you notice what it's, you know, what its front legs are doing. And I don't remember what the wolf's front legs were doing, which kind of makes me question, like, what exactly I saw at that point. Because I just don't remember that detail. You know, it was, like, too far away for me to notice its eyes or its smell or anything like that. But it always looked like a wolf. At the time, it was just, like, such an adrenaline rush. It was the most terrifying thing I'd seen at that point in my life. So, I mean, I saw it. I was, like, transfixed looking at it for probably 4 or 5 seconds. I, like, couldn't stop looking at it. You know, I'm, like, running. I'm in danger of running into a tree, but I can't stop looking at it. Finally, I have to, like, turn my head to make sure I'm not going to crash into a tree because we're still off the trail. We're just taking, like, the shortest path back to the house. So we're just kind of, like, cutting through, you know, like, the thick of the woods. So we're getting closer and closer to the house, and we're both just, like, full-on sprinting at this point. I keep looking over my shoulder. It's still on two legs. I look in front of me, you know, make sure I'm not going to crash into anything. My girlfriend's still right in front of me. And I look back over. And eventually, as we got closer to the yard, like to the backyard, I kind of lost sight of it, but it didn't come closer to us. It looked like it kind of slowed down. And then when I looked back, it was gone. But it didn't seem like it was coming closer to us. It felt like it maybe peeled off in the other direction, or it just kind of stopped running with us. By the time we burst into the yard, it seemed like it wasn't with us anymore. I feel like I need to acknowledge that it can sound kind of stupid. Like, it's hard not to laugh sometimes when I'm like, yeah, I saw a wolf running around on two legs. But it's just in that context when you're already so afraid, you know, like you're already feeling kind of trapped and like fearful for your life. And then something starts moving in like a very unnatural way. It just starts moving in a way. It's like, it's just not supposed to move that way. I don't know. That was just absolutely terrifying. There was just like there's a whole higher threshold of fear that things got kicked into when it stood up. Like, I was already afraid, already like terrified. And then it stands up and starts moving like that. And I'm just like, what the fuck? Like, it just seemed like, in the moment, it feels like supernatural or something. It just doesn't, it seems like you're just entering some deeper circle of hell or something. Because at first I was just afraid of of getting mauled by a wild animal or something. And then it starts doing something it just should not be doing. So, you know, I was kind of in shock. Like, I could just, I don't know how to convey it, but like just the feeling in your arms and your legs, they're like kind of shaky. But yeah, I was just very, very afraid and still kind of coming down from that. But as soon as we came into the yard, I was like, did you see that? And she was, she's like, yeah, what do you mean? Like, what were we just running for? I mean, if I remember right, she was shaking too. I mean, we were both pretty terrified for obvious reasons, but you know, I could tell she didn't know what I meant. Like, I said, did you see that? And she was, you know, kind of confused. Like, yeah, I saw that. We were just running from it. And I was like, no, did you see it stand up? And she just looked at me kind of confused and then kind of smiled like maybe I'm kidding. And I was like, that thing. And she's like, yeah. I'm like, the wolf, you saw that. And she's like, yes. And I was like, it stood up and kept running. And then she laughed at me. And then it was like, it was just crushing because I realized she'd been just ahead of me the entire time, leading the way. Like, she was the one kind of like dodging and weaving through the brush. And then I was following her. I was the one kind of keeping an eye on the wolf. She only saw it for the first, like, you know, 30 seconds that we were around it when it was just kind of standing there. So I didn't know what to say. Like, there was this kind of self-consciousness that settled on me that, I don't know, like I felt like inhibited. Just as soon as I told her and I got that reaction from someone who'd been there with me, you know, but just hadn't been looking for the, you know, I mean, I guess this whole thing, it must have taken, like, as I'm watching it run, that must have been like 20 seconds total, you know, like it actually was a really short window. And she just wasn't looking back when that happened, you know, she was looking ahead. And just, you know, getting that reaction, like just seeing the look on her face and just, yeah, it just really kind of closed me up. It was like, I just had that feeling for a long time afterwards, you know, and especially if you're like 17, any kind of social pressure is, that can make you shut your mouth, you know, pretty easily. Like I said, at first she thought maybe I was messing with her or something. But I was clearly like afraid and I was dead serious and she just didn't know what to make of it. Like, yeah, she just didn't know. I mean, cause she didn't have a category for this either. It wasn't like this was an established cryptid or like, I mean, she didn't know any more than I did that like other people had claimed to see something like this. So it just came totally out of left field as far as she was concerned. And yeah, I don't know. She just didn't know how to react. So, you know, we burst into the house and I'm like immediately telling my family who's there. Like I tell my parents, I tell my younger siblings and, everyone is just kind of looking at me sideways. Like they can tell that I'm serious, you know, and I don't lie about this kind of thing. Like I'm not prone to, this type of thing. Like I don't know what to call it, but like this sort of thing does not happen to me frequently. Like I don't even really have an interest in this, or I didn't at this time. So they don't really know what to do because like, how would you react if someone says they saw a bipedal wolf? Like, what are you supposed to say? Like, so I, you know, I know how it sounds and it's not like most people are gonna be like, oh, cool. You know, like, yeah, definitely. But I guess that my younger brother Elijah did believe me. I didn't tell anyone about this story for a few years after this first day. Like I just tried not to think about it. And then when I eventually had the confidence to be honest about it, my younger brother Elijah was like, oh yeah, I remember this. And, I was like, okay, tell me what you remember. And then I just, you know, zipped my lip because I wanted to make sure I hadn't like confabulated anything or like warped any details. And he, you know, to my relief, he conveyed everything back to me as I remembered it. So I'm like, okay, I'm not like changing any details here. So that was like 7 or 8 years later, but apparently my younger brother Elijah believes me. But you know, people react kind of like, I don't know. It's just what you're telling them is so abnormal, even if they trust you. And even if you're not prone to saying things like this or whatever, you're not like, you know, you don't have any kind of reputation that would make people not believe you or something. They just didn't know how to react. I mean, I wouldn't know how to react if someone said all this to me. She went home, like my girlfriend went back home. And, you know, we all just kind of went about our day and I did not go out into the woods for a long time. And, I was always like kind of urging people to go out in the woods. Like if they must go out in the woods and like, you know, bring other people with you and like bring a gun or something. Cause at first, I mean, once I realized people were not like, it just made people feel uncomfortable when I told them what I saw, I at least just said, you know, I saw a wolf back there. You know, and like, you should just be careful. I didn't set out looking for a cryptid and I hadn't heard any of these stories. I didn't have any interest in like cryptids or anything. I didn't know anyone had even claimed to see anything resembling what I'd seen. But I was in a public library in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I was looking at a certain section that started with P. I was a philosophy major, so I was looking at, you know, the philosophy section, and it was, you know, it was a very sad, small section, and right next to it was the paranormal section. So there were these two books that looked interesting. One was called Midwestern Strange by B.J. Hollers, and the other one was called I Know What I Saw by Linda Godfrey. So I, you know, I didn't know what they were, but it looked kind of interesting, so I opened them up, and literally chapter one of the Hollers book is about the Beast of Bray Road or the Michigan Dogman. I don't know. I can't even convey how, like my jaw was like literally on the floor. Like I'm just blown away. Cause like I said, I didn't know that anyone else had ever claimed to have seen anything like what I'd seen. And this is like years later. So I just opened up this book and then, you know, chapter one is about upright wolves. like people have seen in Michigan and in Wisconsin. Like apparently sightings are concentrated in Michigan and Wisconsin, which is where I lived at the time. So that was like incredibly vindicating, not just that other people had claimed to have seen something like what I'd seen, but like in the same area, like in the same part of the country. And that made me feel a lot more confident. Like, okay, there's like a rhyme and reason to the sightings. Like other people have seen the same thing. That lends credibility that like, okay, this was not, you know, some weird dream or something. Like, no, this actually happened. So Linda Godfrey, who's a wonderful lady, but she just recently passed away, but she was a reporter in Wisconsin. She sort of stumbled on this where there were lots of people in her area in Wisconsin who had seen like upright wolves. She ended up compiling a bunch of these stories, and she became convinced pretty quickly that like these people were sincere. It was just such a weird like array of people who had all claimed to see something very similar, and it was even like on the same stretch of road for a little while. That's why it's called the Beast of Bray Road in Wisconsin. But the lore is a little complicated because what people have definitely seen, like I said, is some kind of upright wolf-like thing. You know, people have seen it chasing down deer and like attacking them. They've seen it like eating roadkill. They've seen it just running through a field. That's like basically the core of it. But then there's all this other stuff that gets added that I don't really take that seriously, where it does sound a little more explicitly like supernatural. Like there's this one detail that really annoys me. I don't even know where it comes from, but it's like, oh, the Dogman only appears on years that end in 7. And that just sounds like, I don't know, very goofy to me. I have no clue how that would even work. And
what year did this happen to you?
2012.
Okay. yeah. What? How old were you?
I was 17.
Mm-hmm.
7, yeah. But they also say like it smells a certain way and like it has like glowing eyes or something. So I don't know, like I'm not really doubting what people are reporting, but it just seems like the more details you add like that, the more it seems like you're crossing some kind of line that goes beyond what everyone is saying they saw. Like I said, the essential core of it is just some kind of upright wolf-like thing that runs around and, you know, sometimes you see it attacking things like deer. Sightings do date back in Michigan like quite a ways. Like there is this one detail with regard to the connection to Michigan that I find really annoying because a lot of people misunderstand where this comes from. So there was a guy who wrote a song, like kind of a parody song, that included something about the Dogman. Like it was like a Halloween song. He was like a radio DJ or something. It was like 50 years ago. So he wrote like a funny song that said something about the Dogman. And it was like I said, some kind of like Halloween themed song. And a lot of people think that that's where it all comes from for some reason. Like, there was this song and then people started saying, you know, I saw the Dogman. So like all the lore just comes back to this song. This guy made a funny song and like now all these idiots think it's real. And like what actually happened is that, first of all, there are sightings that go back before that song. And second of all, when that song came out, there were people calling in and this guy was kind of flabbergasted because he was just like, he didn't think he was doing anything serious. But then there were all these people who called in like, you know, I actually did see that thing that you're talking about. And that's a phenomenon you see sometimes with these shows like Art Bell's show. I've just heard this randomly that he did like an episode about shadow people or something. And then all of a sudden he was just like overwhelmed with calls with people who had like seen the thing that he was talking about. And like he was partly responsible for popularizing the phenomenon or at least raising awareness about it. But the song came out and then a lot more people had heard of it. And a lot of people who had seen it said, oh, that's what I saw, which is exactly what happened to me. But sightings go back before that song came out.
All right. We'll be right back after this quick break.
I was just sitting there in the public library, you know, with my mouth hanging open, just like, I was like so relieved. Like, it was just the last place I'd expected to find any kind of validation or vindication of any kind. Like I said, I had just tried not to think about this. Like, I initially told a few people And then I just shut up about it. And I really tried not to even think about it. It's actually kind of upsetting in a way to realize that you even can do that. You know, like that was, that's something that's been hard to process as I've been like revisiting this story in my mind, like in preparation for this. And that's the one detail that honestly bothers me the most, is that I spent a few years at least choosing to not think about it because I had no idea what happened to me. I didn't know what to, I didn't know how to explain it. And I knew what it made other people think of me, but I really succeeded in like suppressing it for a while. Like I really, like every time it bubbled up, even for a moment, I was like, nope, not thinking about that. And I don't know, that's just kind of alarming that people can do that. Just choose to not think about something that causes cognitive dissonance. But I'm sitting there in the library and then I open this thing up. And yeah, it's just the completely unexpected validation and vindication. Just having a category to put it in, like I mentioned, like just knowing there was a name for it, that like other people, it's somehow that alone was, you know, a source of relief. So the start of me being kind of a skeptic was around like 17 or 18. And by the time I found this book, sorry if I wasn't clear on the timeline. By the time I found this book, I was maybe 26, you know, so I was already like kind of disillusioned with the skeptic community at that point for completely other reasons. But yeah, I mean, like just finding this book or these two books, yeah, it was just a huge relief, and it was not anything I ever expected, you know, ever expected to find. It definitely has opened me up to listening to other people and like sort of taking their experiences more seriously, even if I don't know how to explain it in the moment, or if it doesn't exactly fit with my worldview or like my background assumptions, I still want to hear them out and not just say, well, that couldn't have happened, you know, the way that you think it happened. Their experiences are real, at least. And like just setting aside the question of interpretation, you can still accept that, you know. And it was just, it was frustrating to start talking about this like with skeptics, and then they're saying, oh, maybe it was like a fear-induced hallucination or something like that. Like just not even wanting to allow that, like, I saw what I saw. So I want to like do other people the courtesy of like, yeah, you saw what you saw, you know, and then we can talk about different ways of interpreting it. But I did, you know, I'm sure this is coming through, but it did kind of make me resent the skeptic community a little bit more, because, well, actually a lot more, because I just didn't properly deal with this experience for years. And part of it was because of them. It's just a very like intellectually stifling environment. But just being worried about what people are going to say or like how they're going to react to you. Yeah, I mean, that really does make people not want to share what happened to them. And I think that one thing that your show has proven is that lots of people are having very unusual experiences, and they're, you know, often self-censoring. And I just don't think that that's, I don't think that's any good. I don't think people should be self-censoring. It's very interesting this stuff is happening to people. And regardless of how we interpret it in the end, there's absolutely no reason to like discourage people from sharing what they experienced. So yeah, like I try to be open-minded and more agnostic. Like I just have kind of a default agnosticism about almost everything these days. But yeah, I'm not sure how I interpret my experience in the end. Like I can think of very like conservative explanations that, you know, don't really veer into the paranormal or supernatural. I can also think of more paranormal explanations, but I don't know which one is right. But yeah, I don't really know. I mean, I know what I saw, but beyond that, I can't really be certain. I like really went into depth trying to come up with like a naturalistic explanation. It's just, I don't, like I said, I don't know if I believe it, but it's like one possible way of explaining what I saw that doesn't require anything like crazy, which I partly did just out of spite for the skeptic community. Basically, just that there are wolves that are on the far end of the bell curve with respect to certain phenotypic traits that are relevant to upright movement. Like, you know, I imagine you'd need a better sense of balance and you'd need like wider paws. And I kind of like tried to guess what that would take. And it's like, okay, look, there are some people who can run a mile in under 5 minutes, but like most people can't. And like, I imagine there are some wolves that just can do things that that other wolves can't do. And then I kind of tried to speculate like, okay, maybe this was like a lone wolf that got dispelled from the pack because we know that lone wolves can move like hundreds of miles away from where they started out. Like there's one that I found that traveled about 1,800 miles in 15 months. And there is a wolf population in like the upper peninsula of Michigan, just not in the lower peninsula. And same in Wisconsin. There's like a wolf population in the north, but not in the south. And some of the dogman sightings in Wisconsin happened in the south as well. So I thought, okay, maybe this is like a lone wolf that gets dispelled from the pack, and it's just kind of, you know, on the far end of the bell curve with certain traits. And basically, we just see a wolf that can do things that most wolves can't do. And I found some dogs who can do this. Like, there's one dog in I think it's in Colorado somewhere. His name is Dexter. And he there was some accident where, you know, his front paws or his front legs were broken, and he eventually just figured out how to start walking around on his hind legs, and like he looks pretty okay doing it. Like it doesn't look like exactly what I saw, but it's like he's moving around pretty nimbly, you know, just on his hind legs. But if you look up Dexter the dog on YouTube, I'm sure it'll come up, but. Yeah, it's like, okay, this is like physically possible, you know, for like canines to do. So yeah, I mean, like if you want to promote like the most conservative, like most naturalistic explanation you can think of, I guess that would be it. And then like the runner up would be like, this is just some weird subspecies of wolf that just hasn't been discovered yet because it looks so much like other gray wolves. But one thing I pointed out is that skeptics often say, like, oh, if this cryptid, you know, whatever it is, whether it's Bigfoot or what have you, like, if this is real, then where are the dead bodies? Like, why have we not found any fossils? Like, how have you not found a carcass of, like, a dogman or a Bigfoot ever? And I think that my explanation has the advantage of, like, oh, we have found carcasses of these things. It's just they look like wolves, you know, because they are wolves. So, like, there's no dead body problem. You can't really run that objection against this particular cryptid. It's something you hear from skeptics sometimes, like, oh, well, if these things are real, why don't we see more, like, you know, camera phone footage of it? And, yeah, that was the last thing on my mind as I'm like, yeah, like the absurdity of like pulling out your phone and trying to take a picture or a video while you're thinking you're about to be mauled to death. That honestly just did not occur to me. It's one of those things that people say that has some surface plausibility to it. But if you've ever been in this kind of situation, and you're actually like afraid for your life, or like something is actually happening and you don't know what's happening, yeah, it just doesn't occur to you to pull out your phone. Smartphones have not been around for that long. I mean, like, if I did have a smartphone in my pocket, I must have just gotten it, because I didn't have an iPhone until I was like 16 or 17. But I don't know, just another reason that line bothers me is because these things have only been around for like 10 years or 15 years. It really has not been that long, so just give it a minute. Maybe there will be more videos, you know. Maybe other people will have, like, a cooler head in the same kind of situation I was in. But in any event, it's like, these people are generally not gettable. Like, I don't know how else to put it. Like, there's nothing that's going to convince them. Even if you showed them a video, they would think it was doctored or something. And, you know, I mean, they can always fall back on something like that. So I don't know why you would risk your life just to maybe convince like an obstinate skeptic that what happened to you was actually real.
So after speaking to Emerson, I wanted to speak to a biologist or wolf researcher in the area to ask some simple questions about whether or not an animal like that might be in the area and whether wolves are known to get up on their hind legs. If so, how often do they do that, and how long do they stay up on their hind legs? After all, Emerson's story is very strange, but it's really just the story of a wolf doing something really unusual. It's not like this is something that defies the laws of nature or physics or anything like that. It's essentially just a wolf being really weird. So we began reaching out to many different experts in Michigan and the surrounding states. I honestly figure that this would not be hard. It typically isn't hard. Our show has a very good reputation, if you don't mind me complimenting myself. I always say that we're the most normal paranormal show. But to my surprise, people were really not interested and talking about anything related to the Michigan Dogman. And some of the emails telling us that they weren't interested were not exactly friendly. What I did find out from some people that we spoke to off the record and from DNR studies is that there are no known wolves at all anywhere near where Emerson was in Bloomingdale, Michigan, which I find really interesting. Like I said, though, nobody wanted to talk to me about the Dogman or anything remotely similar, and I began to suspect that the reason for that had a lot to do with what Emerson told me about the radio DJ who made the Dogman famous. By the way, the song itself is wild. I'm going to play a little sample of it right now.
A cool summer morning in early June is when the legend began. At a nameless logging camp in Wexford County where the Manistee River ran. 11 lumberjacks near the Garland Swamp found an animal they thought was a dog. In a playful mood, they chased it around till it ran inside a hollow log. A logger named Johnson grabbed him a stick and poked around inside. Then the thing let out an unearthly scream and came out and stood upright.
It seems to me that because of this song, many people out there believe that everything relating to the Dogman is completely made up by those DJs, including the sightings that people have had. So yeah, Steve definitely did quite a bit of hoaxing when it comes to the Michigan Dogman. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that all of these people who experienced something strange out there are just imagining it because Steve made a song on the radio, especially not the people who experienced it long before. And in the case of Emerson, he didn't know about the Michigan Dogman until he went online to look up what in the world happened to him when he was out in the woods on that day. I think the Dogman situation is a great example of why you should be extremely vigilant and critical about what you choose to believe, but I also think it's unwise to disregard everything related to a topic just because some of it is fake. I think it's natural to want to put a binary label on things like this, but unfortunately, when it comes to the paranormal, I just don't think that's how this works. This is really not a binary subject. It's very messy. In the next episode, we will be hearing from another person from Michigan who had an encounter with a weird wolf/dog-like creature. But this one is quite different than what Emerson experienced, and it's quite different than Steve's description of the Dogman. Thank you once again to Emerson and Steve Cook for speaking to me. Also, congratulations to Emerson. He actually became a father during the time we are working on this episode. Congratulations. This has been episode 113. Stay tuned for part 2 of the series. This has been The Michigan Dogman Part 1, and you've been listening to Otherworld. To my surprise, I was finally able to get a hold of somebody who works with wolves. They do this in Minnesota instead of Michigan, but that's close enough for me. Either way, I just wanted to finally speak to somebody who knows about these creatures and ask them some very basic questions, like whether or not wolves display any strange behavior that might cause people to think they experienced something paranormal, like getting up on their hind legs, and what they think about the entire Michigan Dogman legend. So, I talked to Maeve Rogers. She works at a wolf research and outreach program in Minnesota. She previously worked with wolves in Yellowstone National Park. And this is our conversation. Maeve, what title would you like to use? How shall I introduce you here?
Well, Maeve Rogers, I am an education and outreach specialist for a wolf project in Minnesota. And I've spent a lot of time following wolves and watching them in multiple different environments. So I know a lot about them.
How and when did you get started doing this?
So I grew up in Northern Illinois, and I don't really know exactly when it started, but I have always had this deep fascination with animals, but wolves specifically. And in Illinois, we really don't have wolves. So as soon as I could, I moved to Montana to pursue, hopefully, a career in wolves, and went to Montana State University to study wildlife biology. And I chose the school specifically because of its close proximity to Yellowstone National Park. And eventually I was able to volunteer and work with the Yellowstone Wolf Project for 4 or 5 years. And that was my start.
And what do you do now?
So kind of around the time of the pandemic, I actually moved to Minnesota, up in some of the most remote parts of the state. But something about Minnesota just kind of piqued my interest, because the wolves there act completely different from the wolves in Yellowstone, and I really wanted to explore that a bit more. So I am still currently in Minnesota working with wolves. So for the past 4 years, I have been up in remote Minnesota studying and tracking wolves out in remote landscapes by myself, typically. A big part of my job is trapping wolves and putting GPS collars on them.
Maeve, I wanted to ask you before we go further, the fine biologist community of Michigan and wolf community of Michigan was really not interested in talking to me. Are you surprised by this?
No, I wouldn't say I'm surprised. I think kind of like the academic community and more professional community. Well, not that this isn't professional, but it's kind of like the professional wildlife community doesn't like to typically comment on certain stories that people have. I'm not very surprised to hear it, though.
Honestly, I am not super surprised either, especially the more I learn about the history of the Michigan Dogman. But I did just want to ask very simple questions to these people originally. Now that I have you, the first question I have is, are wolves known to approach people out in the wilderness, or are they animals that are generally elusive and hide when they hear somebody coming?
So I think this really depends. And it really depends, I think, on the population of wolves you might be around. For example, when I worked in Yellowstone, Yellowstone has some of the most habituated wolves in the world, just because they are super used to humans being around them, watching them every single day and tracking their movements in such open landscapes. They don't approach humans normally, naturally. It's usually just a sign of habituation, as I said, just due to exposure to human presence without any sort of negative impact to them. Another way that wolves can get habituated to humans is through access to human food and trash. And this can lead to problems, but typically wolves do not approach people whatsoever. Wolves are truly some of the most, if not the most, docile animal in the woods that you could come across, in my opinion. I have spent thousands of hours in the woods by myself, and I have been attacked by a multitude of other animals, but never a wolf. I have been attacked on many occasions by a mama grouse protecting her babies. I've also been attacked by white-tailed deer on many occasions. Squirrels are also a lot more scary, in my opinion, than wolves are. But yeah, I've never really felt threatened or scared of wolves, even though they are a big predator. You know, generally, they really don't want anything to do with you and will run the other direction. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't realize, because of kind of the exaggerations with stories in our society. People think that just because a wolf is a predator, they might be threatening or aggressive towards people, which it can happen. I'm not saying that's impossible. It is very unlikely. And there are ways to go about handling a wolf encounter properly. I would always suggest just making yourself look as big as possible, menacing, aggressive, scream at the wolf, throw things at the wolf, chase the wolf. I've done all these things. If I've felt like a wolf has gotten a little bit too curious and, you know, I've never had an issue. And again, with all the time that I have spent in the woods, going to areas that wolves have directly spent time in, if anybody was going to get attacked by a wolf, it probably would have been me by now. And I, you know, I still have not had any situation where I've truly felt fear around a wolf, but I still respect them as the wild animal that they are. And, you know, there is still like a little bit of an unpredictability about them, but it's not really something that I have come to fear through my experiences and knowledge.
What did you think of the two stories that I told you about that we had on this show?
Well, I mean, I think both sound pretty terrifying in their own ways. I am a little bit, you know, skeptical, maybe because I haven't experienced something like that. And I come from a very scientific background, but I'm not really one to discredit anyone's experiences, especially because I wasn't there. But yeah, they do sound pretty weird, but terrifying nonetheless. I don't really know what I would do if I was in a situation like that other than try to get away.
Do wolves ever get up on their legs? I mean, a theme of a lot of these stories, especially with the Michigan Dogman, is bipedal behavior. Like, do wolves get up on their hind legs? And if so, why?
So in short, no, they do not. While dogs and wolves may occasionally rise on their hind legs for brief periods, this is often when they're trying to reach or interact with something. This is not a natural and definitely not an effective way for moving for them. They are quadrupeds, so that means that they walk on four legs, while we are bipeds and we walk on two. And dogs, like wolves, they're built for movement on all fours, and their skeletal and muscular structures are designed for speed and endurance when chasing fast-moving prey. So not for upright bipedal walking. This would not be energetically efficient for them. They wouldn't be able to sustain the speed and distances that they'd need to take down these fast-moving prey like deer, elk, bison. Wolves also have these elongated limbs and specialized joints that make them excellent runners and excellent for endurance, but they are definitely not built for walking on two legs like humans.
So that being said, like, what do you think of this story of something that looked like a wolf rising up on its hind legs and running full sprint?
Definitely interesting. And I think stories like this, kind of just like stories in general, they often might arise from like a mix of human imagination and encounters with wildlife. I think wolves in particular have been a source of mystery and fascination due to their elusive nature and behaviors.
You said that's really unlikely, but is it impossible? Is it a possibility that he saw a wolf displaying strange behavior? And is it common for wolves to display strange behavior, or what an average person might think is strange?
No, it is not impossible for wolves to go up on their hind legs. Like, I have seen wolves on their hind legs jumping for things and kind of bouncing. Like, if a crow flies around to kill, I've seen wolves get up on their hind legs and like snap at the air and try to get at them, but it's not like a way that they would choose to typically move.
What do you think of this whole Michigan Dogman thing? Did you get a chance to look into this at all? Like, what do you think of that whole legend?
I mean, growing up in Northern Illinois, there's a town that was less than an hour away from me that kind of had a similar dog man story. And I think I kind of grew up hearing about like certain creepy things in the woods, and I always took an interest in them. I guess folklore in general, I think it's really fascinating. And again, I think that these stories often arise from like the mix of human imagination and encounters with wildlife. Folklore and myths, especially in like certain Western narratives, have long painted wolves as symbols of danger and destruction. Many of us grew up hearing the tale of the big bad wolf. I did, but you know, I always like to remind myself too that not everybody shares that perspective. And some Native cultures specifically have a different narrative, where one where wolves are seen as brothers and their fate is tied to their own. So I think it's kind of like our views on wolves might be shaped by what we're exposed to growing up. And if people that you are around fear or hate wolves, you know, you might too. And if you grow up respecting them, that perspective stays with you as well. beyond cultural narratives, human wolf conflict is often intensified by bad press and misinformation. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there about wolf depredation on livestock, and that's a huge conversation point when it comes to wolves. But here in North America, there's only been a few cases of wolves actually attacking and killing people. And by a few, I mean like two, but nothing in the lower. There's been no reported attack in modern history, at least, of wolves attacking or killing people.
How has the fear of wolves affected the wolf population in North America?
Yeah, that's a good question. It has deeply affected the wolf population. You know, I think when Western settlers came in, they had ideas about things and kind of this idea that, you know, I guess like, I believe our attitudes towards wolves say more about us than like the animals themselves. I think wolves represent the unknown, the wild, and like untamed aspects of nature. And these are things that humans have long struggled to control, and they can be unsettling. And I think that we came in with this idea that we wanted to conquer nature, and wolves, along with other predators, were kind of looked at as just nuisance vermin that made living harder. And instead of trying to find a way to work alongside our wildlife, we just resorted to killing. So wolves were about the most widespread land carnivore mammal that we had here in North America. And due to predator eradication, wolves were completely eliminated from the lower 48 states. Wolves, along with other predators, were eliminated, but wolves kind of got hit the hardest. They lived in just about every state across every different type of ecosystem and were completely eradicated. Wolves do have a place in the ecosystem, and a pretty important one as an apex predator. And after the eradication efforts in the 1970s, we created the Endangered Species Act, kind of revolved around the wolf so that we could bring wolves back to places that they historically lived. And the hope is that we can have wolves be able to safely move into places like Wyoming and Idaho, down to Colorado, and eventually meet up with a small population of wolves, Mexican gray wolves, in New Mexico and Arizona, and kind of start having more genetic connectivity throughout the populations there.
So, Maeve, it sounds like you're a little skeptical of my dogman stories here.
Yeah, I could maybe say that.
That's your job, though, right?
It is, yes. I am very science-based. I believe in data. Like, I really like to see hardcore data to, you know, start being able to draw conclusions. But, you know, that is the professional side of me. But then there's also the side of me as a biologist. I would think that having other species that are not yet discovered, even though we've probably been living alongside of them, is really interesting to me. But yeah, I can't really draw too many conclusions until I see evidence.
I wanted to ask you, what do you think about the hyperfocus on wolves in terms of paranormal beliefs, folklore, things like that? I mean, I know it's really easy for people to say that it's a frightening animal. People are scaring themselves, imagining things, but you know, you really don't see stories like this about bears. Not only that, these stories exist across cultures throughout history, people having weird experiences specifically with wolves. Like, what do you think of that pattern?
Yeah, I think that alone is super fascinating, especially long before modern technology allowed people to really communicate across continents, and different cultures and people groups developed like eerily similar folklore and stories, like tales of large mysterious creatures, whether they're wolves like we're talking about, or Bigfoot, the Yeti, or even dragons, like exist across vastly different cultures. Yeah, it's just really interesting. Despite having no known way of sharing these legends at the time, it makes me wonder, like, why do these themes persist in human history? And while we can't draw a definitive conclusion, it is really compelling to consider how our ancestors living in different environments and places arrived at such similar narratives about the creatures.
As a person who works with wolves, like, do you hear any strange stories about them? Are there any patterns to strange behaviors or experiences people have with wolves that you hear?
For sure. I mean, I hear a lot of stories where, you know, they were out in the woods alone and got surrounded by this massive pack of wolves. And, you know, they were so scared that they had to climb up a tree and escape. I hear things like that all the time. I've heard many stories about people just being out in the wilderness, going down a trail or a road and seeing this wolf track that was like the size of a dinner plate. I've heard that quite a bit. Or just wolves being like these massive, massive creatures, you know, that are 200 plus pounds, which is really funny because actually up in northern Minnesota where I work, the average size, the weight of a wolf is around 60 to 62 pounds. They really don't get too big.
Maeve, I have to ask, have you ever had any strange experiences of your own while you're in the woods?
Hesitant for this. But yes, I really feel like, yeah, I mean, I had one moment that I keep kind of going back to and really wondering like what actually happened. And in the moment it was really terrifying, but kind of having some time away from it, I have different ideas of, I guess, what I could have seen or what happened, but.
Are you willing to share this?
Yeah, I'll share. So a big part of my job, again, is just going out into the woods and figuring out what wolves are doing based on the GPS locations. We also work with a large array of remote trail cameras. So on this day, I was maintaining a series of cameras that we had like way out in the middle of nowhere, you know, in a lot of places that we hike, I feel like people really haven't been in centuries because the places are just really unappealing. You know, there's a lot of like walking through swamps and bogs and like super thick forests with mosquitoes and ticks and everything. So I was way out there kind of going down a little game trail and I was using my phone to track the trail I was on and seeing exactly how far away I was from the camera. It just kind of felt like a lot of things went silent around me. And a lot of times when that happens in the natural world, that kind of means there's a predator or something that prey animals or birds feel that they need to conceal themselves around. So I, you know, deafening silence kind of, and I hear a snap of a twig or something in front of me. And I look up from my phone and I see something, not exactly sure what it was, but it was large, about the size of the small sapling trees that were around the game trail I was walking down. So maybe anywhere from like 6 to 8 feet tall. And it's just this mass. I didn't really see any definitive features to cue me into what it was other than it being gray. You know, I froze for sure. And I'm one of those people that kind of freezes in situations to try to get like a grasp of what could be going on. And I wanted to know how to appropriately react to the situation with whatever wildlife I was about to encounter. So I kind of just froze there. I'm literally employed to identify animals and I'm very well versed with animals up in northern Minnesota. And I still can't like really describe what it was or what I even think happened. The only thing that I really remember is just gray. And it happened so fast and it moved just into the woods and out of sight. And I remember sitting there still in the silence and all I could hear, and I just remember this moment very clearly, was just boom, boom, boom. Just three very distinct bipedal steps going into the woods. And then nothing. It was silent. It kind of just felt and seemed like it disappeared because nothing else happened after those three steps. And I kind of snapped back to reality and dove into a bush next to me because then I was like, okay, something's going on here. I don't know what just went into the woods. And just that feeling of like not knowing what's around you is very scary. I stood just trying to hear anything else because I figured if it was a moose, I would be able to pick up on that a little bit more because moose are also very elusive and scared of people, but they're huge animals. And when they get scared and start running through the woods, you're going to hear it. And you're going to hear their hooves hit the ground and their distinct gait with their four legs crashing through the woods, hitting branches as they go, snapping logs and twigs and just creating a whole mess. But all I heard was silence and those three steps and nothing else. Yeah, so that, I guess, is my story. And I don't really have any other conclusions other than, like, something was there. It was definitely alive. And I think the scariest thing that I could think of is honestly just a man being randomly out in the woods where I was and disappeared into the woods next to me. I consider myself to be pretty agile in the woods, but I don't know who else has that much experience going through the woods where I was and why anybody would be out there. But yeah, it just kind of disappeared.
How does that make you feel, especially in the context of your skepticism towards what we've been talking about?
Part of me feels like really frustrated that I couldn't figure out what it was, because I really love seeing animals out and being able to like keep this list of like all these wild creatures that I've seen. And I think that's been kind of gnawing at me a little bit, is not exactly knowing what I saw, whatever it was. But yeah, I think that must be the most frustrating part, is just kind of not really knowing what was there. And I guess needing that validation and like the proof with my science side of the brain. But then like the curious part of me really was like, well, what was that? Like, I don't know. It's hard to say. The biologist, like researcher side to me is very data oriented and very focused on science and needing like definitive answers. But then there is this other side of me, like my personal side, I guess, that is super interested in all these other things, you know, that we will never be able to explain and never have answers for, just because that's the world. And I don't think we were meant to know everything. You know, I've had interesting, like unexplainable things happen that like I can't really draw conclusions from, but I do know that we have these animal populations that live at such low densities, whether they're endangered or threatened, you know, kind of like how wolves used to be. To me, it makes me think that, and especially in the area that I've worked at, I've had to go and try to recover some of our dead study animals. And even though we know pretty much exactly where they are due to their GPS collars, it still can be incredibly hard to document things and to gain data and to recover animals that have passed. So it kind of makes me think that if there are other populations, part of me really is like so curious and I want to like just know more and to be able to prove some of these theories and these like stories from folklore. It would be super interesting to me, because how are all these different people across time coming up with such similar stories? It just piques my interest quite a bit. And just knowing what I know about, you know, more rare or elusive animals, they are hard to find even in modern day with the technology that we have. And we're still discovering new species, especially in the ocean. The ocean's not even like, it's barely been explored and researched, and we're still finding out so much more. I kind of think both sides blend a little bit, that, you know, I'd like that hardcore data and science, but I am also super curious to the aspects that we don't know and we're still trying to figure out. And again, going back to wolves, they are some of the most studied land mammals and carnivores of all time. And we are still learning really important fundamental things about them and their ecology. So the fact that something else could be out there, like something, some real aspects to these stories that people have, is, yeah, just very compelling to me. Always open to it because I'm super curious. But again, it's just like one of those things that I'd really like to see some proof.
Okay, thank you to Maeve for speaking with me. If you want to learn more about the work her and her organization does, they're called the Voyagers Wolf Project. I love it when I get an unexpected otherworld story like that, especially when it comes from somebody like Maeve. I was not entirely surprised by her skepticism about the Michigan Dogman. That point of view was kind of why I wanted to get somebody like her on the show to talk about this. One thing that did stick out to me was near the end when she mentioned how hard it is to recover bodies of wolves in the wild, even when they know the exact GPS locations of where they should be. I feel like anytime the existence of a mysterious creature gets brought up, people end up asking, why haven't they found any remains yet? It's a very fair question, but it's interesting to know that that's harder to do than most people realize. In terms of the Michigan Dogman, I think it's safe to say that the origins are a hoax. Steve made that pretty clear. But I don't think that means that all the people who have experienced something strange in Michigan related to wolves or dogs are just imagining it or creating a hoax themselves. My thoughts are that when people experience things like this, it's very confusing and destabilizing. And lots of times they go out looking for answers. I think the Michigan Dogman created a name and it gave people in Michigan an answer to something that they didn't have an answer for before. People were suddenly able to apply a name to something that they had experienced long ago and something that people continued to experience. I think assigning names and categories to this stuff can be a bit of a distraction sometimes. That's one of the reasons why I rarely do it. I consciously avoid coming in at the end of these episodes and saying things like, this person clearly encountered a dogman. I mean, how could I or anyone possibly know that anyway? But when it comes to the paranormal, I really believe that this stuff could be caused by many, many different things, or maybe a lot of it could all be connected to one thing. I have no idea. All of these experiences that we cover on the show could be connected to many different individual things, or maybe there's a few things causing it all, or maybe it's all just one thing. I have no idea. People have had strange experiences with wolves throughout time, and there's folklore from cultures all over the world. It's not just happening in Michigan. I think it's a really interesting pattern, and I honestly hope we get more stories like this in the future, because if we're ever going to find answers to some of this stuff, I think the first step is to find patterns between these very strange experiences that people have. That brings us to the end of this episode. I want to thank Emerson, Grace, Nancy, Steve Cook, and Maeve Rogers for speaking to us for this series. By the way, Steve Cook's album, The Legend of Michigan's Dogman, 25th Anniversary Collector's Edition, is available on Spotify for streaming if you're interested. It includes 10 different versions of the famous song. This has been The Michigan Dogman, Part 2, and you've been listening to Otherworld. Otherworld is executive produced and hosted by myself, Jack Wagner. Our theme song is by Cobra Man. The soundtrack of this episode is by North Americans. This episode was edited and engineered by Theo Schaefer. Our artwork is by Cul-de-Sac Studios. Nikki Kate Delgado is our associate producer. Production help by Haley Pearson. Please show us your support by subscribing, leaving a 5-star review, and telling your friends about Otherworld. If you want to hear bonus episodes, you can become a patron at patreon.com/otherworld. Our social media is at otherworldpod. Thank you to the team at Odyssey, J.D. Crowley, Jenna Weiss-Berman, Leah Reese-Dennis, Rob Morandi, Eric Donnelly, Matt Casey, Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, and Hilary Schuff. Follow and listen to Otherworld now for free on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. And finally, if you or somebody you know has experienced something paranormal, supernatural, or unexplained, you could send us your story at stories@otherworldpod.com.
In hopes that the folks at Otherworld would not ask me to take this down, I thought I'd chill a little more for the show and talk about my favorite episodes. Most of these stories are ambiguous and open-ended. If you love The X-Files as much as I do, then you're already familiar with this sort of setup. Mulder and Scully interpret the same events in very different ways, and from their perspectives, their beliefs seem pretty much justified. So if you want some firsthand accounts of strange experiences, I would start with these episodes. The Expedition. So this is a great Bigfoot story. The woman interviewed is a YA author of some kind, and she recounts a Bigfoot sighting she had with her friend in a particularly remote part of Texas on a vast property that's been in the family for many, many generations, going back to when Texas was in Mexico. After their relatively up-close sighting, they called Bigfoot researchers, who then explored the territory with her. So if you're looking for some firsthand Bigfoot lore, do check that one out. The next one is called Zozo. This starts off as a basic Ouija board story, and like all other stories of this kind, it can be explained by the ideomotor effect, confirmation bias, and so on. But there's an interesting detail in the story. I've always thought that it would be relatively easy to test this sort of thing if it was real. You could put a random number or some message on the other side of the room out of view of the people using the board and ask the spirit to spell out whatever it says. But the man in the story did exactly that. His friend opened up his phone on the other side of the room and he asked the spirit if he could read what was on the screen. It said yes, and then proceeded to spell out the text message, which the people using the board could not see on the other side of the room. The text read, "Hey, bitch." Now, maybe these friends greet each other in a similar fashion quite often, and the users of the board subconsciously knew this, so the ideomotor effect could still work as an explanation. You could also say it was a wild coincidence. You could also say the man was just lying. Those are all possible explanations. So, of course, it's not proof positive that they were interacting with something real, but it is the exact kind of test you'd want to run on this sort of phenomenon, so for that reason I found it interesting. Next, the Black Widow and the Ball of Light series. These are the episodes where you first meet Wendy, although she makes some other appearances. Wendy is an amazing lady who's often called a clairvoyant. I love Wendy. Everybody loves Wendy. I'm not going to say more than that. Just listen to any and all Wendy episodes. Next, The Broken Man. This is the first episode of Otherworld, and it got me hooked immediately. It's a classic ghost story, but I found some of the details compelling. Next, Kareem and the Djinn. You're not supposed to talk about them, lest they invade your life, so proceed at your own discretion. This is probably the funniest episode of Otherworld. Jack didn't respond to the email at first. His team has to sift through a lot of submissions, investigate their interview subjects a bit beforehand, etc. And they dismissed the message right away because they thought it was someone making a joke or making fun of their project. Kareem has several encounters with Djinn, and it builds up to, Kareem claims to have been, I don't know how else to put this. He claims to have been jacked off by a djinn. And the host, as I said, did not respond to this email, but he bumped into Kareem in real life, and he eventually became convinced, if nothing else, of his sincerity. Next, The Messenger. This is another early episode about a woman who feels compelled to share messages with others. Sometimes these messages come in dreams, sometimes spontaneously, but she can't have any rest until she does share them. And when she does, they often provoke extreme emotional reactions in the recipients of the message. One story I found compelling had to do with a recently departed man who needed to say something to his boyhood friends. There is something. This was meaningless to the woman, but she shared it anyway, upon which she found out that these childhood friends made a pact, one that the recipient of the message had completely forgotten about. They agreed that whoever died first would try to get a message back to their friends and let them know whether or not there was something, anything at all, after death. So she told the man's friend, "There is something." There are many other episodes I've loved, like the UFO episode Cloaked, the NDE episode called The Valley, the Haunted House episode The Hidden Staircase, parapsychology episodes like The Receiver and Slashed Tires, and I also loved the fake seance. It's just a lot of fun to listen to these strange encounters, even if you're approaching skeptically. I think a lot of the listeners do. Even if you're dead set against any of this possibly being real, I think it's valuable to know what people are experiencing, and to know firsthand what the claims actually are. Otherworld is, if nothing else, a wonderful journalistic resource that collects firsthand stories about paranormal experiences. You can approach the show as a believer, an investigator, or as an anthropologist. It's just a fun show. And if you want more content like this video, you can also check out my interview with Dale Allison on his book, Encountering Mystery. So with that, happy Halloween, everybody. Otherworld crew, Please do not make me take this down, although I will if you ask me to. All right. Thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll see you next time.